So today, I thought I would talk a little bit about the four foundations of mindfulness and about the Buddha's scripture, Buddha's teaching on the four foundations. I think maybe many of you know that the practice of mindfulness, vipassana, originates or has its kind of scriptural origination in a text called The Four Foundations of Mindfulness. The four areas where mindfulness is established. And this scripture of The Four Foundations of Mindfulness is considered in Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka and Burma and Thailand to be a very special text. It's revered greatly there. And people will memorize it. People will sometimes chant it at people's deathbed because it's considered so special. However, if you actually read the text, it's not. It has the literary quality of an extended telegram. You know, it's not this, you know, great, inspiring, evocative, mythic language that some scriptures are like. But it's rather kind of dry, and it's more like a dry manual. But it's kind of nice that way, because what it means is it's unadorned. It's kind of very matter-of-fact and straightforward, and says, basically, this is what you can do, this is how you can pay attention. And it doesn't have a lot of fluff or a lot of stories or a lot of... and it's not adorned in any kind of way. And this is very important because I think that mindfulness itself, to do the practice of mindfulness, is it's best if we do it in an unadorned way, where mindfulness is done in the context of some great simplicity, of just being here present in this very moment without infusing it with all kinds of myths or stories or aspirations or dreams. It's just our life as it is in this very moment. And that's actually a phenomenal gift to begin appreciating and our life in its simplicity as it is, rather than living in expectation of something better down the line. The sutra, however, does offer a promise. So it is not completely 100% unadorned. And what it's promising, or what it offers, is freedom from suffering. And I thought I would read for you the pertinent sections. The Buddha said as follows: "This is the only way for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for reaching the noble path, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness." And then at the end of the text, the Buddha says even... "Whoever is practicing these four foundations of mindfulness for 7 years can expect one of two results: highest knowledge here and now, or if there still be a remainder of clinging, the state of a non-returner. Let alone 7 years, should any person practice these four foundations of mindfulness for 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, for 1 year, then he or she may expect one of two results: highest knowledge here and now, or if there still be a remainder of clinging, the state of a non-returner. Let alone 1 year, should any person practice the four foundations of mindfulness for 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month, half a month, then he or she may expect one of two results. Let alone half a month, should any person practice these four foundations of mindfulness in this manner for 7 days, he or she may expect one of two results: highest knowledge here and now, or if there still be a remainder of clinging, the state of non-returner. Because of this, it has been said, this is the only way for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for reaching the noble path, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. Glad in their hearts, the monks in the audience welcome the words of the Buddha. So it's a great promise. You know, 7 days, 7 years is one thing, but to do this for 7 days. And then twice the Buddha says, this is the only way. And this is very problematic for people in the West, where we're familiar with a religion that says there's only one way. And many of us maybe came to Buddhism because Buddhism wasn't kind of offering that kind of limited view. However, if we understand this is the only way, not that Buddhism is the only way, but that paying attention is the only way, that the only way, you know, only by bringing our attention to our life can we find freedom from our suffering. And so there's maybe many ways of helping us bring attention to our life, but attention is the basic common denominator of all the different forms of practices that lead to freedom from sorrow and lamentation, pain and grief, and for reaching the realization of Nibbana. So so what are the four foundations of mindfulness? Herein, a practitioner dwells contemplating the body in the body, ardently, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and ill will. He or she dwells contemplating the feelings in the feelings, ardently, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and ill will. He or she dwells contemplating the consciousness in the consciousness, ardently, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and grief in the world. He or she dwells contemplating the Dhamma in the Dhamma, ardently, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and ill will in the world. So the four foundations of mindfulness are the body, being mindful of the body in the body, the feelings in the feelings, the consciousness in the consciousness, and this expression called the Dhammas, the Dharmas in the Dharmas. Now the way that this is interpreted in certain areas of modern Buddhist teaching is to understand the four foundations of mindfulness is an attempt to describe everything that we can be aware of as a human being. That this particular practice of the four foundations of mindfulness is a practice that is waking up awareness to all aspects of our humanity, our human experience. There's nothing which is considered outside the domain of what we can pay attention to. There are certain other forms of Buddhist practice or other religious practices that focus on particular things. You bring our attention to our breath, or bring attention to a mantra, or bring attention to a certain aspect of life. And it can be very valuable to do that. But what sometimes happens is that if you're only paying attention to the breath, then the person might not have much familiarity with how to stay awake for their emotions. Or if they have a practice which is very emotional, there can be ecstatic practices to be done, then they might not have much sense of awareness of their body or awareness of their cognitive functions and their thoughts and patterns of thinking. The modern interpretation of the four foundations of mindfulness is that it's meant to include, the four foundations are meant to include all aspects of our human experience. And the trick of a mindfulness practitioner is to bring a balanced awareness to all aspects of our life and not to leave anything out. And this is called the one way. When I remember for me, I did Zen practice for many years. And then I was introduced to this Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And it was very helpful for me because Zen practice had not taught me very much about how to be aware of certain aspects of my experience, in particular my emotions. I could sit fairly well in my Zen practice. I could get pretty concentrated on the breath and on my posture. I could sit still for great lengths of time and have wonderful experiences. But I wasn't really noticing or learning much about how my emotional responses are to the world. And there were times actually where I was actually numb to them. I wouldn't be paying attention to them. I'd have emotional reactions and I kind of didn't even know I was having them. I would be acting out of them and speaking from them, but I wasn't really that aware. If I was aware of them, I didn't know what to do with them. I was just confused. When I was introduced to Vipassana practice, it talked about how to include emotions as part of the practice, and that was really valuable for me because that was a part that had been left out. But I remember how happy I was the day in when I was practicing in Burma, doing this Vipassana practice, paying attention to the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and it dawned on me that I could bring awareness, I could bring mindfulness to anything that I could experience. Anything that was an experience, I could be mindful of. And I became really happy when I realized that. It was like suddenly there was this, I understood the possibility of freedom. I understood that no matter what was happening to me, there was a possibility in that experience to be free if I brought my attention to it. And since there isn't much, you know, to my life in a sense, I'd say it this way, the realms of suffering and happiness belong to the world of experience, having experiences. So when I was aware that, when I became aware that I could pay attention, be mindful of anything that was an experience, then I knew it was possible to become free in anything that was an experience. And what there is, it wasn't my experience, so I didn't really care that much about. Awareness, mindfulness has a function that if you can bring really clear mindfulness to anything that's happening, you don't have to understand it. You don't have to kind of not even necessary to penetrate what it is you're paying attention to, but if there's really clear awareness of anything, that awareness itself is not going to be caught up in the object of awareness. And if part of you, your awareness, your mindfulness, is not caught up, that part of you is free. That part of you is not preoccupied with the concerns that you have. So a lot of what's happening in mindfulness is we're trying to bring attention to the details of our life, our experience, so we can and to strengthen our ability to see clearly, so we can really see clearly what it is that's happening at any given moment. And in seeing clearly what's happening in that given moment, having in a sense a little bit separation between awareness and the concern. And seeing that separation, or seeing that awareness is larger or more encompassing or freer than our preoccupation, then we know, oh, here's some freedom. Here's some space. I don't have to be always come enmeshed and entangled in the various things that I'm caught in. So the text says, the practitioner dwells mindful of the body in the body, ardently, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and ill will. This is kind of the introduction to this whole instruction manual. So first is the expression ardently. To be ardent, to have energy, to have effort, to have some kind of interest in doing the practice. Not to kind of... I remember when I was a freshman in college, I took a painting class. And I never really painted much before in my life. And so I went out and bought the paints and the canvas, and I'd be standing there at the easel in the painting class, and kind of holding the paintbrush kind of like it was like something really delicate, and I'd kind of putting my paint on the canvas like so carefully, like it was like, you know, like the canvas would just disintegrate if I pressed too hard or something. Just kind of. And at some point, the teacher came over to me and said, you know, whenever people start painting, they're always so tentative. What you want to do is hold that brush firmly and just paint. Just kind of do a stroke strongly and boldly. And so it's sometimes that way in our practice. It's sometimes we're kind of tentative in engaging ourselves in the practice. We hold back, perhaps out of laziness sometimes, perhaps out of fear of really being present for what's happening inside of us, what's really going on for us. It can be very frightening to stop the busyness of our life and all the ways we get propped up by the activities of life and just sit down and be with ourselves. So laziness, fear, sometimes leaves us kind of tentative in the practice. So the Buddha suggests that you should be ardent. And ardent, now it's not supposed to be striving, it's not supposed to be tight and stressful, but to have some great enthusiasm or zeal. This is what I'm going to do. I'm really going to sit down here in this period of meditation, and I'm really here to pay attention with some enthusiasm. Clearly comprehending and mindful. Well, this is what we're trying to develop, is clear mindfulness, clear comprehension of what's happening. So we sit down and we try to bring our clear ability to notice what's happening right now. There tends to be a lot of confusion for many people about what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice, in mindfulness meditation. Some people, whether they do it consciously or not, are pursuing not clear seeing, not clear comprehension of what's happening in the present, but they're pursuing things like calmness. They think, if I only get really calm. And it's actually possible to kind of latch on to the breath and let the breath, and kind of use some soothing feeling of the breath, and to kind of lull one into kind of a soothing kind of state or into a calm state. And to think, this is what meditation is about. This is what mindfulness is to get calm. And it's nice to get calm. I mean, I don't want to prevent anyone from getting calm. But if the calm is taken as be the point of meditation practice, then the calm will stand in the way of developing a more mindfulness and clear comprehension of what's going on in the present moment. If even unconsciously we're kind of pursuing a kind of de-stress state or relaxation in the practice, then that intention, that drive to get relaxed, will stand in the way, will interfere with any drive or any movement towards seeing more clearly what's going on. There's all kinds of intentions that people can have besides simply clearly comprehending what's happening in the present moment. Calmness, relaxation, joy, bliss, insight, those are kind of the positive goals some people have. Some people have negative goals. To get rid of something. You know, if I can really get rid of this headache, or if I can really get rid of this depression, or can really get rid of this, the critic inside of me, or if I can really get rid of all this busy chatter in my mind that never seems to stop. So there's a drive to get rid of something. And again, if that intention to get rid of something is strong enough or active enough part of what we're doing, then it gets in the way of the central intention, central point of mindfulness practice, which is simply to see clearly what's happening in the present moment. So it's valuable to look at your intentions of practice and see, where do you fall? What is your intention? And can you simply take refuge? Can you simply be devoted to simply developing clear comprehension of what is happening right now, with no extra intention added on top of it, to be unadorned in your spiritual practice? So it's just simply to notice, oh, this is what's happening now. Maybe because the word mindfulness has gotten to be so popular. It's used all over the place now, and they even teach mindfulness at Kaiser. You can go take a class in mindfulness, and there's best-selling books on mindfulness practice. Maybe it's kind of like a trendy kind of word, and so when it gets kind of trendy that way, then there's a lot of associations that get added to it that are just confusing. So sometimes I like to not use the word mindful, but to use the word notice. We're doing a noticing practice. I mean, it's kind of unsexy. Someone asks you, you know, what's your spiritual practice? Oh, my practice is noticing things. You know, well, gee, you know, that's unfortunate. I mean, if you say your spiritual practice is mindfulness, then, oh, yeah, I've heard about that, and that's really great. And wasn't that the program on television? They talked about that, and, you know, it sounds really great. But if you talk, my practice is noticing. It doesn't go very far. But I like using the word noticing because for that very purpose, because it kind of shakes us up from kind of any complacency we have about understanding what the practice is, and just noticing, kind of a very unspecial kind of thing to do, just to notice what's happening. What good is that? Well, this is the only way. For the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for reaching the noble path, for the realization of nirvana. To notice what's happening in the present moment. So then it goes on, and it says, mindful of the body in the body, ardently, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and ill will in the world. Removing covetousness and ill will. So this is kind of just the introduction to the practice. To start doing the mindfulness practice, you have to get rid of covetousness and ill will. So that seems kind of ambitious, as if it was an easy thing to do. In practice, one of the important aspects that we're paying attention to and noticing is the degree to which desire, greed, or ill will, aversion, are coloring how we see our present situation. Again, there's all these ways in which we adorn the present moment. And we adorn it sometimes with desire and ill will. It's like this filter that we put on. We see the world through the filters of desire or ill will. And mindfulness, to be clearly mindful, is to discover this balance, this midpoint, where we can be present for something without seeing it through the filter of desire or ill will. And this can get very, very subtle. It can be very gross, desire and ill will. And some of us are very familiar with them. But they can be very, very subtle. And actually, the more experienced the person gets in meditation, the longer they've done meditation practice, the more they have to be sensitive to the subtlety of desire and ill will and how it creeps in to the meditation practice. To be sitting here, to come here and sit, and you kind of show up and you say, well, I'm just going to sit here and just be mindful of whatever arises. And that's the practice after all. And then what happens is that you get a little bit of a headache. And this, I dedicated myself to be mindful of whatever happens, but headache doesn't count. So that, you know, I'm going to push that away, or I'm going to just go for, maybe if I go for a jog for an hour, then I'll come back, and once that's gotten rid of it. I don't know if that was the best example, but it can be very subtle. We have, that doesn't count. So I'm just going to get rid of that. That knee pain, that doesn't count. I'll be present for anything that arises, but not knee pain. So I'll move. Or there can be very subtle desires. I'm going to be present for whatever arises, but the proof that I'm doing it right is that I feel some joy. So there's kind of this desire that arises to do it right. And that desire kind of filters or colors what the experience is. So a lot of what needs to happen in a practice is to pay attention to the movements of desire and ill will, that pushing away or holding on, that might actually be coloring or affecting your present moment experience. And then if it's easy, not to let go of them enough, so they're not actually the filter through which we're experiencing the present moment. They might still be there, but if we see them clearly enough, then we're not going to be affected by them. So to be ardent, to sit with some enthusiasm, to be aiming towards developing clear comprehension, which is unadorned or uncolored by greed or ill will. Another way of saying this is to sit with acceptance, to sit accepting what's given to you at any given moment. What is it? What's happening to you right now is the given. I love this expression, the given. The given means kind of like what's most obvious. It's given that at 5 o'clock we'll end. It means that it's obvious. It's the way it's supposed to be. It's what the schedule says or whatever. Certain things are given. And so to say mindfulness is to pay attention to what's given in any given moment means that it's not in our control and we're not manipulating it. It's just what has arrived. But I like it, we call it the given, because it's also kind of a gift. To discover through insight or through experience or through faith the tremendous power and beauty and effectiveness, efficacy of sitting mindful, not trying to do anything except clearly comprehend what's happening in the present moment. That is a wonderful thing to discover. It's not an easy thing to discover because we're so interested in manipulating our situation, improving it or making it better. But to have this uncompromising acceptance of this experience right now is the gateway to freedom in the way the Buddha talks about. To have an uncompromising acceptance of this experience right now, regardless of what's happening. Not needing it to be any different, but using this present moment experience as a place where we're developing our clear comprehension, our clear seeing, to see more deeply what's going on here. And as we see more deeply, we actually pay attention to actually what's really happening in the present moment. What happens for many of us, we are living several steps removed from actually what's happening. We're living in the world of our abstractions, our thoughts and ideas of what's going on, rather than the details of the present moment, what's actually happening. The way the Four Foundations mindfulness works, the reason why it can be so effective in freeing us from suffering, is that we need to bring our attention to the seat of our suffering. And the seat of our suffering is always something that's happening in the present moment. If we're living removed from the seat of our suffering, we can't really use mindfulness to address it. So what I mean by this is, what's a good example? Say that I hate driving my car, and so when I drive, I abhor the idea of getting into my car. When I drive my car, I'm just miserable and kind of depressed. And so there's a kind of suffering there, a state of suffering. So I could easily kind of maybe perhaps recognize that I'm suffering and I abhor driving the car, and kind of in a naive way kind of, well, believe this is, must be true, that cars are just terrible to drive, and then start acting out in abstract ways a more complicated relationship to cars. I might start probably cars wasn't the best example, but I might start fantasizing about a carless society, and then living my world in fantasy all the time. Or I might be spending my time in fantasy, thinking about all the ways in which what's wrong with all the other cars in the world, and thinking, well, that car, those kinds of cars are bad because of that, and those kinds of cars are bad because they use a lot of gas, and then I'm kind of miserable because I'm thinking all the time bad thoughts about other cars, and which adds to another layer of suffering on top of it. What we try to do in mindfulness is to actually get back to the origin in the present moment of what is it, the trigger, what is it, the hook that's gotten me into my abhorrence of cars. And because the abhorrence of cars might not be kind of the first generation event, it might be that the reason that I hate cars is I'm afraid of them. Because once upon a time I had an accident. And when I look at my car and thinking about driving it, this fear kicks in. And the fear kicks in, and the fear then builds on itself into kind of an aversion. And the aversion builds on itself to kind of a hate. And the hate builds on itself to become kind of a fantasy about the carless society or about what's wrong with all the other cars. To sit quietly in the middle of our experience is to sit quietly enough so we can clearly comprehend the original hook. And if you can understand the original hook, in this case maybe it's fear, then you can see that it's possible that mindfulness itself, awareness itself, it sees the hook clearly enough, sees the fear clearly enough, that awareness itself can set you free from being enslaved to that fear or acting blindly out of it. But if you don't see the fear, then even if you're dealing with the hate, it might be kind of spinning your wheels in a sense, because the fear is still the operating principle affecting all this. Does this make some sense to you, or am I just this example kind of silly? So to sit quietly, clearly comprehending in the middle of our life, is to sit with what's happening in the present moment, and then trying to bring clear comprehension. See, what's actually going on here? What's actually going on here? What's actually going on here now? As opposed to looking for what we hope to happen, to get rid of something or to have something better happen. But simply to sit. And this is why mindfulness is so uncompromising. For some people, maybe it's too uncompromising, because in the moment, it doesn't offer any hope. Isn't that great? In the moment, it doesn't offer any hope. But actually, the Buddha offers a lot of hope. Right? This is a pretty hopeful text where it says, this is, you know, let alone 7 years, 7 days. You do this really carefully and well, you'll become free. The hope is freedom, is really complete experience of liberation. But the avenue to it, the gateway to it, is this hopeless practice of just simply being willing to sit in what's happening right now and developing clear comprehension of what is happening now. I consider this to be a very loving thing to do, because to love a friend, I believe, it's a healthy kind of love, is to really see the person as they are and accept the person as they are, not for who we want them to be, or not for what they do for us. And And so there's an uncompromising willingness to look clearly at what's happening and let it be what it is, not trying to get rid of it or change it or manipulate it. I think of it actually as a loving act. And what you'll maybe find is, as you do the mindfulness practice, is that as you settle in and get deeper, more deeply involved, it does begin feeling like a loving act, a loving experience. And feelings of kindness or loving kindness, of metta, will well up by itself, simply from having unadorned mindfulness of the present moment. Pesha.
In your example, your awareness brings you to the fact that it's fear that's really going on. And then what? So now you're aware of fear.
So you...
How are you free? You just are experiencing fear rather than some other fear.
It's possible to be casually aware of something like fear. It's possible to be somewhat, you know, kind of, to be aware of it kind of from a distance. What we need to do in mindfulness is to bring ourselves as closely and fully and mindfully into the fear as we can, to feel it as intimately as possible. And as we bring more and more clear seeing, clear comprehension of the fear, the clearer we can see it, the less we'll be caught by it. Because to be caught by something, to be enslaved by something, means that there's some element of unawareness that's at play. And if we overcome that unawareness by awareness, the clearer the awareness is, the less we are going to be living in the fear. It's kind of, maybe say it this way. It's kind of like many of us are entangled in our concerns. And then we live in our entanglement with our concerns. Awareness is another place to live. And as the awareness becomes clearer and stronger of what's happening in the present moment, we're actually bringing something which is not entangled with a fear to bear on the fear. But you can't just be 5% aware of the fear. You have to develop the skills to learn how to really bring your full awareness to the experience of fear. And when you've really kind of entered the fear fully, with as much mindfulness as you can, and the fear is not pulling you in, you're not getting lost in your stories about the fear, or if you're not getting frightened by the fear, you know, fear on top of fear, but are really, really just there, mindfully aware in this balanced way without any desire, ill will, any desire, aversion, you'll find your freedom right there. You'll find the release there. The release will happen on its own. You don't have to create the release. But it takes ardency. Ardency is a wonderful word. It can't just do it casually. Yes?
So do you get into the physicality of fear?
That's one powerful way of getting into it very closely, is to feel it in the body. And really, the body is a very intimate experience. It's a physical, direct experience. So to feel fear in the body is one way to feel the fear very, very intimately, very personally, very directly. In that the physical body is not a story. It tends to be a lot easier to be present for something like fear if you feel it in the body. Sorry? Well, let me say, I wanted to say a few more things. So the four foundations of mindfulness include our physical experience. That's the bulk of the text, at least one of the versions of the text, focuses on mindfulness of the body. It's a really important foundation for most forms of Buddhist practice. The second foundation is, I'll just go through, just name them. They're usually called feelings. And the third is states of consciousness. But the fourth one is interesting because the first three have a lot to do with just simply being aware of what's present for us. If there's fear, being aware of fear. If there's a feeling, being aware of the feeling. If there's a sensation in the body, just being aware of the sensation. The fourth foundation has a lot to do with paying attention to not what's simply happening, but paying attention to what our relationship is to what's happening. And this is a real key to the whole practice of mindfulness, is beginning to pay attention to what our relationship is to what's going on. Are we in some ways entangled and knotted up in the experience? We get knotted up through desire. We get knotted up or entangled through aversion. Through identification, this is who I am. By relating our self-image or self-worth to a particular experience. Are there ways in which we relate to it? This by judging it. This is the wrong thing to have. This is the right thing to have. It should be a little bit different than this. What is the relationship we have to the present experience? Because our suffering that we add to our life, the unnecessary suffering we add to our life, arises out of forming a relationship to experience, to life. The Buddha's teaching is actually very uncompromising, which is the suffering that Buddhism can help you alleviate is a suffering that you've caused for yourself in the way you've chosen to relate to what's happened to you. What's happened to you is just what's happened to you. And, you know, maybe it's painful, maybe it's uncomfortable. But if we cringe from it, if we resist it, if we hate it, if we judge it, there's all these ways in which we enter into relationship to it. And the suffering that the Buddhist practice is trying to free ourselves from is a suffering that comes from the way in which we chose to relate to the present experience. So Buddhist spirituality puts tremendous responsibility on each of us to try to become aware of how we've entered into a relationship with what's happening in the present moment. And it has to be with what's happening in the present moment. It's always something in the present moment that is the cause, that is the condition for our suffering. It might have had its genesis long in the past, but the clinging or the aversion, the desire which is causing the suffering, is something that's happening right now. So to sit in the present moment, clearly comprehending what's happening in the present moment, is to also pay attention to how are we relating to this that's happening right now. How am I relating to my knee pain? How am I relating to my impatience? How am I relating to anything at all? And seeing, is it necessary to relate this way? Is it necessary to relate through aversion or clinging or fear? And the more clearly mindful we are, the stronger, more powerful the mindfulness is, the more likely you are to see the seat of where your choice, the seat of choice, where you made a choice to relate in a certain way to the present situation. And when you see the place of choice, then you can see the place where freedom is possible. But we don't have choice unless we see the choice. And part of the function of mindfulness is a mindfulness practice is to develop our capacity to notice things, clearly, to develop enough stability and calm and clarity so we can really see the point of choice. And then we can become free. Allison.
Earlier in the part about getting rid of desire or ill will to do this practice, it seems to me that can set up some interesting things that you feel like you have to change instead of allowing or accepting. So can you...
There's two ways of understanding that. One is that When you first sit down to meditate, to review a little bit some of the momentum of desire and wanting, and review your intention when you first sit down. And if you have some relatively gross movement of desire, ill will, maybe it's a relatively gross event. And if it's easy to let go of it, let go of it. So, for example, if you sit down to meditate and all you can think about is cashmere sweaters, and you really want the most beautiful cashmere sweater in the world, and you've been thinking about cashmere sweaters for the last week, and you sit down to meditate and you notice you're completely desirous of covetous of the cashmere sweaters, maybe it's easy enough just to let go of it. If it's, you know, a simple thing like that. If it is simple. So one way of understanding this is if there's something simple, like that's easy to let go of it so you can help you not so be present. The other way of understanding this is that when we first sit down to meditate, bring your attention or look around and notice, is there any, just be alert to notice if there's any desire or aversion that seems to be coloring the experience of the present moment. And if there is, then bring your mindfulness to that. Not to get rid of it so much, but to get mindfulness, to get clarity about it. And to get enough clarity about it so that it's no longer coloring your experience. It might not go away entirely, but if you understand something well enough, then it doesn't have to color the experience. For example, I sit down sometimes and with a desire to get calmer. That happens to me. And when I notice that that's my desire when I sit down, then I try to be careful not to, in kind of semi or unconscious ways, to be using the mindfulness of the breathing to pursue calm. Oh, there's a desire for calm there. That's what the desire is. Okay. But really what I'm going to do now is just sit here in the middle of my experience as it is and not pursue calm, even though that desire seems to be there. Does it make some sense? Is it responding well enough to you? Well enough? Yes. Of conscious states. Of conscious states. States of consciousness. Yeah.
As opposed to feeling, which is, I feel sad.
Right.
Or I feel happy. Versus, I'm pursuing something.
Well, you see, this is this is a whole other talk. But the second foundations of mindfulness, which is unfortunately usually translated into English as mindfulness of feeling, doesn't have the same popular meaning of feeling as many of us understand the word feeling. It's more the feeling tone refers to. And what the teaching is that all experiences have one of three tones to it. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. It's very important to start noticing the pleasant or unpleasant or neither tone of any experience, because it's very often based on the very simple pleasant or unpleasantness of something that we enter into a relationship to it. We want to push it away if it's unpleasant, or we want to hold on to it if it's pleasant. We complicate the situation by getting entangled with it because of our relationship to the pleasantness and unpleasantness to it. So the second foundation has to do with noticing the simplicity of pleasant or unpleasantness in the experience. And all experience is either unpleasant, pleasant, or neither unpleasant or pleasant.
Unconscious state
And the third foundation of mindfulness is to be aware of states of consciousness, which would, many of us in English would call feeling states, emotions. So when our awareness, when our consciousness, when our mind or heart has desire or generosity, when it's contracted out of fear, for example, or when it feels expansive, when it's angry or when it's happy. Notice very simple states of mind, states of heart like that. Well, the second is related to everything else, because everything that's an experience can be pleasant or unpleasant or neither. So, if you feel a lot of pressure in your chest as you're sitting, that's experience of pressure might be pleasant or might be unpleasant. It might be neither. If it's pleasant, then there might be this whole scenario of desire and self-gratification and self-congratulations that come in. Oh, I'm sitting in meditation, I have this wonderful, pleasant feeling of pressure, and isn't it great? If it's an unpleasant sensation of pressure, then this whole scenario of self-loathing and, you know, oh, I'm doing it wrong, and I must be following my breath wrong, and how can I do it differently, and I hope no one notices that I have this unpleasant sensation, or let's get rid of it. Let's take an aspirin. If it's an emotional state that arises, the emotional state might be unpleasant. And it might be that our simple aversion to that unpleasant emotional state is because we don't like to feel something uncomfortable. Or if it's a pleasant emotional state, our relationship to it might be arising out of the pleasantness, our way we relate to, we like pleasantness, so we want to be engaged in pleasant sensations. So the second foundation of mindfulness relates to all the others. Anything which is an experience. So some people will do mindfulness practice for a period of time. The only foundation of mindfulness that they pay attention to is a second foundation. And it's very powerful to do that. To only pay attention to the pleasant or unpleasant quality of an experience. And what happens as we get better and better at paying attention to that, we start noticing how our relationship, the kind of relationship we start forming based on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. And it's possible to find a place of ease, a place of balance, where we don't have to relate to it at all. We can just, oh, there's an unpleasant situation. We just let it be aware and just let it be there and not get entangled in it. And that's a kind of freedom. So probably we should stop. We're running over. And it was a given. They were supposed to stop at 5. So the four foundations of mindfulness are extremely powerful. And they're powerful in their simplicity. So I encourage you, as you do the practice, try to stay as simple as you can in the practice, and let the practice simply be becoming more aware of what's actually happening, as opposed to using the practice to try to change what's happening. So thank you for this lovely day. It was lovely to sit here, and I enjoyed very much just the chance to sit a lot. And those of you I met in interviews, it was very nice to meet and talk. And I look forward to next time. May you all be well.